Treasury's Day for the appellant, Robert Poyson.
In McKinney v. Ryan, this court, sitting en banc, held that for a period of approximately 15 years, from the late 1980s and continuing through the mid-2000s, the Arizona Supreme Court consistently applied an impermissible causal nexus test to non-statutory mitigating evidence in violation of Eddings. The court found that as a matter of Arizona state law, non-statutory mitigating evidence was only considered relevant mitigation if a defendant was able to establish a causal connection between the mitigating evidence and the defendant's behavior during the commission of the crime. The court also explicitly overruled the Ninth Circuit's panel decision in Shad v. Ryan, finding that the clear indication rule announced in Shad was an inappropriate and unnecessary gloss on the deference already required under the ADPA. Mr. Poyson's case fell within this relevant time period, and the Eddings error that occurred in his case occurred both in the sentencing court and in the Arizona Supreme Court. This was the basis for one of Mr. Poyson's claims in his appeal before this panel, where he argued that the Arizona state courts failed to properly consider and give effect to evidence of his chaotic and abusive childhood, his mental health issues, and his long history of alcohol and substance abuse. The majority of this panel specifically found that the record showed that the Arizona Supreme Court applied a causal nexus to this evidence. However, the record did not reveal whether they were doing it as a matter of just weight or an impermissible screening mechanism. The panel found
I thought that the trial judge had found that it was just vague allegations and didn't give it weight on that account, not because of any causal nexus.
I think that you're talking about the sentencing court, Judge Acuda. I think that it was a little bit muddled. I think that the court did say vague allegations, but when you're looking at the language it was talking about, it was conflating both statutory and non-statutory mitigating evidence. And if you look at there's language about vague allegations, but also there's language regarding the causal nexus. If you look at ER 864 to 866, and I know that it became a stronger argument or a stronger point, I guess you could say, when the Arizona Supreme Court looked at it, because the Arizona Supreme Court glossed over the sentencing court's use of the causal nexus as to each point of all of these mitigating factors. And so I do believe that the court did apply causal nexus to some extent to evidence of substance abuse, although it was less strong than the evidence related to mental health and a dysfunctional childhood.
Well, it would appear that the sentencing judge did apply a causal nexus test with respect to substance abuse on, as far as the statutory factor, and then relied on that as a non-statutory mediating factor, the same as above, if I'm recalling it correctly.
I think that's correct. You kind of conflated it rather than distinctly looking at non-statutory mitigation. And so I think...
And you would agree, though, that we have to look at what the Arizona Supreme Court did because they engage in reweighing. And in terms of the causal nexus.
That's correct, unless there's a question as to what they were doing. And I think that there were a couple places in the analysis of the Arizona Supreme Court where they glossed over the causal nexus. And I think that in that case, that is when you would need to look at what the sentencing court actually did. For example, with mental health evidence, it talked about, it said that the Arizona Supreme Court said the trial court found that Poyson suffers from certain personalities disorders but did not assign any weight to this factor. When in fact, what the sentencing court had done was pointed out that because Poyson failed to establish a causal connection between his mitigation and the crime, it did not constitute mitigating evidence. And so I think what the Arizona Supreme Court did didn't fully take account of what the sentencing court was actually doing in applying the causal nexus.
So one thing that McKinney did decide, in addition to the Eddings error, is to conclude that Eddings error is not structural. So would you move to the harmless error?
Yes, I will, thank you. We believe that Mr. Poyson presented extensive evidence during sentencing and in the sentencing memorandum about his chaotic and traumatic childhood, his long personal and family history of alcohol and drank alcohol and used drugs extensively during her first trimester of pregnancy with him. At one point, she admitted that she had used LSD and marijuana as often as she could get it during that time. In addition, she continued to drink heavily and use marijuana throughout her pregnancy with him. Because of his prenatal exposure to alcohol and drugs, Mr. Poison had neurological impairments that were consistent with FASD.
But as a practical matter, I mean, you're going through the facts. We're familiar with the facts as they were presented in the record. As a practical matter, the Supreme Court is the top decision maker. It's the one that decides how much weight it's going to give to various facts. It looked at the facts and said it didn't give them much weight or any weight. Why is it going to be different if they now have to use different words because the Ninth Circuit has said these words don't work? Why is there really a substantial injurious effect with respect to the Arizona Supreme Court's determination?
I think that in the McKinney opinion, the court was clear that what the Arizona Supreme Court was doing all these years was it was only considering evidence to see whether or not there was a causal nexus.
Well, it knew there was evidence, correct? It recites the evidence. It knew the evidence was there. However, it did not have to doubt that it knew the evidence, so it isn't like it said, I won't look at this evidence. And so the court, as of the body, decides, we've looked at this evidence, but we don't think it has a mitigating effect.
I think the problem, and this was pointed out in the McKinney opinion, is that it did look at the evidence, but it only gave weight to evidence that met the causal nexus test.
Well, it says, in our view, as the Arizona Supreme Court, we think if there's not a nexus between this background, these background history facts, and the actual murder or the actual offense, we're not going to give it much weight or any weight. Well, why can't the top state court that makes these decisions do that?
I think that there's a difference, Judge Ikuda, and I think that it's clear.
It's a semantic, right? It's simply beyond a semantic difference. But what is the Arizona Supreme Court going to do on remand?
I think that what needs to happen is that, given that if this court finds that the sentence was actually invalidated, an invalid sentence, then I think that, as we argue in our brief, in Magwood v. Patterson and in Wilkins v. Dodson, the Supreme Court was clear that any time you grant a writ of habeas corpus, you're invalidating the underlying judgment, whether that is conviction or sentence. And if you're invalidating the underlying sentence in this case, then the only remedy is for this court to vacate the sentence, remand it with instructions to grant the writ.
And then we say in Stiers it was a question of state law, and we allowed the Arizona Supreme Court to just review it and correct the constitutional error.
I think that Stiers is distinguishable, Judge Ikuda, because it involved a Clemens error. In Stiers, the Arizona Supreme Court had struck an aggravating circumstance and then failed to reweigh the evidence that was already before it. And when you look at that, the Arizona Supreme Court is actually reviewing an already constitutional sentence. And in this case, when the sentencing court was
decided, the Supreme Court has never held that the issuance of a conditional writ of habeas corpus necessarily renders non-final a conviction or sentence that was predicated on constitutional error. We didn't say constitutional Clemens error, we just said constitutional error.
Well, I think that Stiers did not acknowledge the cases of Magwood or Wilkerson. It did not acknowledge.
You're saying it's an intra-circuit split?
I think that there is.
Are we bound by Stiers? I think we're not bound by Stiers.
I don't think we're bound by Stiers, mainly because it involved a Clemens error, which is different. Now, I think that it's arguable, and I'm not here to argue on behalf of Mr. Stiers, I think it's arguable that in Stiers, it also should have gone back for a resentencing before a jury. However, this case is distinguishable because it did not involve a Clemens error.
I think you would agree, though, that that question turns on whether the judgment is final or not. Right?
That's correct.
In terms of the Reagan analysis, if it's a non-final judgment, then it would go back to a jury. If it is considered intact for certain purposes or remanded, it may well go back for judge sentencing or judge reconsideration.
Judge Thomas, I think that if you are saying that the sentence is invalid, then the underlying judgment is invalid.
sentencing pursuant to Ring, and that's a new sentencing before a jury. You can't just send it back to the Arizona Supreme Court. And part of that is that the Arizona Supreme Court can't be a finder of fact in the first instance. Their only role on independent review is to review an already constitutional sentence. And Mr. Poisson's sentence that came before that court was not constitutional. And so there's no way to know how a sentencer would have reviewed this evidence, considered it, and weighed it.
Well, Sarah, as we said, that was the whole thing was a question of state law that the Arizona Supreme Court would figure out in the first instance.
Well, I think that it is up to the state court to make that determination. However, I think that the fact that this court has crafted different language in the remedies of these cases has created confusion in the state court, and that it would be helpful to the state court if this court gave it guidance. For example, in Williams v. Ryan, the court there basically vacated the sentence, reversed and remanded, and ordered a new resentencing. And in that case, Mr. Williams would have been given a new jury resentencing, and the state conceded as much in its McKinney brief. However, that case settled. Now, later in Stiers and then in McKinney, the language of the court as far as what was to happen was a little bit different. And when it went back to state court, the state prosecutors moved for the new independent review. Now, in Stiers, that could be viewed as acceptable, because it was a Clemens error, which is unique, and it's unique to the error is contained completely within the Arizona Supreme Court. In McKinney, we believe that was wrongly decided and that it should have been a new jury resentencing in McKinney. So we believe that Williams is the better tack here and that is what we would argue is appropriate.
Or if, in fact, we just reverse the district court, if we were to do that, because the question of remedy is not before us necessarily, we could certainly remain and let the district court sort that out.
That's correct, Judge Thomas.
You have about 7 minutes. Do you want to reserve some time, or do you have a couple more topics you want to raise?
If the court has no other questions, I will reserve my time.
Any further questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is J.D. Nielsen. I'm a little loud, so push that way. From the Arizona Attorney General's office, I represent the respondents heavily in this case. If I could, I would like to first address the harmlessness argument. I think looking at this case, in order to determine whether or not any error that occurred here was harmless, we need to look at the aggravation. This is a case of very strong aggravation. We know it's a triple homicide. We know two of the victims' murders were very brutal. One was very protracted, it took 45 minutes. And we also have a strong pecuniary gain aggravator in this case. The only reason these three people were murdered was to steal their pickup.
So could you distinguish this case from McKinney in terms of the aggravating factors?
I think it's a much stronger case than McKinney. First, we have three homicides. I believe McKinney was only two.
Well, two, yes. I think there you have three homicides. Horrific crime here. McKinney was not, it was a bad crime.
No question. Bad crime. I think there's more cruelty here, certainly based on what happened to Victor Bellant. That's the young boy. Murder that took 45 minutes. We know
discuss with us. I'm curious about your view on the remedy. I mean, assuming we get that far, but.
Again, unless there's some reason we want to encourage a split, we have Stiers here, and we know under HIPAA, we look at class reason decision, and that's the Supreme Court's opinion in this. And if we find error there, then we're saying, yeah, the Supreme Court error, but they can't correct the error. I think from a kind of a rational standpoint, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
If we were to, I realize you prefer us just to leave things as they were, but if we were to think that McKinney changed the landscape, then the proper remedy, in your view, would be to vacate the sentence and remand to the Arizona Supreme Court or grant the relief. You used to raise your eyebrows when I said vacate, so whatever we do with the sentence, you wanted to go back to the Arizona Supreme Court to do a redo under the proper standard.
That would be correct, Judge Fischer.
That's what they did in McKinney.
Yes, they did that in Stiers, obviously. And again, I think that makes sense. The Supreme Court has never said in Stiers Ford, the Supreme Court has never said that the conditional grant of habeas corpus affects the finality of a case. Bagwood dealt with the definition of what a second or successive habeas petition was. I don't think there's anything in Bagwood that Gordon Bagwood didn't say it was announcing some new constitutional rule. Certainly didn't say it was announcing a rule that was retroactive. Cases that are already fighting. With respect to whether, I'm sorry, were there any more questions on that?
Okay.
With respect to whether or not there was genetics there in this case, I think you can submit that there was not. If we look at the language,
is there a way to distinguish McKinney?
McKinney tells us that have to look at what the court did with the case in front of it. And I would certainly say that's what we have to do here with respect to McKinney's finding that the Arizona Supreme Court followed this possible nexus rule. We're bound by that, but we're also bound by Mann, which was a subsequent en banc panel that says under HIPAA, if you can read a decision to comport with federal law, you have to read it that way. So I think the combination of those cases, we have here already finding this court, the majority felt that they couldn't tell that it was ambiguous whether or not the Arizona Supreme Court possible nexus screening. If that's the case, then certainly under Mann and under Richter, there can be no relief.
But is that exactly pretty much what we said in Shad, which was overruled by McKinney?
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, I mean, I think when we had this case previously, we were bound by circuit law at the time, which set a little higher bar or lower bar, depending on your point of view. McKinney has altered that considerably. So the fact that in Mann, we said the statement of Mann doesn't really pertain to this particular issue.
Well, Mann was talking about the proper analysis under, well, he was talking about a way to proceed under deferential analysis under the subsection D. And he's
isn't this really a contrary to rather than an unreasonable application case?
Oh, it definitely is a contrary to case. Richter was a contrary to case. Mann invited in a, I'm sorry, let me back up. This is a contrary to case. Yes, Richter is an unreasonable application case. Mann is a contrary to case to apply to. Bound by, well, it's a Mann decision, we're bound by that. They would also argue in this case that the court needs not even to get into this case, you should just issue a mandate. That's based on federal rules of appellate procedure. We argue 41B2D is a default rule that once the Supreme Court
That is usually the case when we've completed all of our work, but we have the pending panel petition for panel rehearing, which we reserved. And I don't think there's a Supreme Court case that requires the court then to issue the mandate when there's a pending panel decision.
So this was a 41. Your arguments were all about 41D2.
Yes.
But this is a 41D1 case where the petition for panel rehearing on bond had not been resolved. So it didn't appear to me that the cases you cited, which were 41D2 cases, were relevant to our procedural posture. Did you find any cases that applied that same rule to a D1 case? Yeah, so 41D1 is when you're saying the mandate pending the resolution of a petition for rehearing en banc, as opposed to a D2 case where you're saying it pending the resolution of a petition for cert.
Certainly, my reading of the case, Your Honor, is that 41B2D announces the general proposition that once a cert petition is denied, that's the end of it. Now, to the extent that 41B might be applicable. That's what Poison argues. The mandate is even more untimely. We know this court originally denied petitions for rehearing on November.
Rehearing on Bob.
I'm sorry, rehearing on Bob.
Yeah.
On November 7th, 2013, under Rule 41B, the mandate was issued 7 days after. Also, from the comments to Rule 41B, that 7 day time period is important. The comments, the 2002 comments, stress that delaying the issuance of the mandate 9 days or more constitutes an unwarranted delay in public procedures. I don't see how that could apply. Enable this court to continue the mandate in this case. We also know under Shan that the Supreme Court said that this court has no inherent authority to withhold the mandate. So apparently, we have to look to the federal rules of appellate procedure. The Supreme Court doesn't suggest there are perhaps exceptional circumstances that justify the delay in entering a mandate. I've looked at the three cases, one from this circuit, one from the Fourth and Fifth Circuit. They all seem to involve changes in statutory law that happened during the pendency of the cert petition. So we don't have that here.
So how do you distinguish Alpha, the Fourth Circuit case?
Well,
because in that case, the Fourth Circuit concluded that it did not have to issue the mandate. Under pretty similar circumstances.
Certainly, we can distinguish all these cases because I believe they're all civil cases. They're not habeas cases.
Habeas case is a civil case.
That's true, but in a habeas case, we have additional strong concerns of identity and comedies. For sure, I do think that they distinguish that. So, I would ask this court to immediately issue a mandate.
about the mandate. We briefed this extensively in our reply, and I think that, as Judge Thomas pointed out, and possibly Judge Fischer, the state was relying on one subsection of federal appellate rule 41, and that was when cert is denied, then the mandate must issue. However, as the court pointed out, in this case, the court issued an order while Mr. Poison's cert petition was pending on April 2nd of 2014. It's docket entry 79, and in that it amended its order saying that it actually upheld the denial of the panel rehearing, but, or en banc, but allowed the panel rehearing to go forward. And I think, according to the D1 section, as Judge Ikuda pointed out, this court had authority to do that, and that there is no reason for the mandate to issue right away. This issue is before the court properly.
Absent that order that we issued, would you agree with the state that the mandate should have issued?
No, because cert was still pending at that time.
No, I mean after the denial of cert.
I think that that's a rule, though I don't think that it's an absolute rule. And I believe, I did address this in my brief, I believe the state was arguing that Shad stated that it was a mandatory rule, and in fact it was not, and then later conceded that. So no, I don't think so. I think there's still discretion there. The second thing I wanted to address was prejudice, again, very quickly. There's no question about the aggravating circumstances in this case. However, the mitigation at issue here, the U.S. Supreme Court has found this kind of mitigation, especially powerful mitigation, in Eddings. The court found the defendant's youth, along with evidence of a turbulent family history, beatings by a parent, and emotional disturbance are particularly relevant. In Lockett, the Supreme Court found that the failure to consider evidence of drug abuse was unconstitutional. In Smith v. Texas, the failure to consider placement in special education and special handicaps, unconstitutional. In Penry, evidence of a disadvantaged background and emotional and mental problems, and in Wiggins, evidence of physical abuse, sexual molestation, neglect, etc. All these
things. How many of those were decided by a jury, and how many were decided by the court, like a Supreme Court?
I cannot tell you off the top of my head. Judge Ikuda, I apologize for that.
Because obviously if the jury was instructed not to consider certain evidence as mitigating, that would be different than a state Supreme Court doing a review in the first instance, a de novo review, right?
I don't follow. I guess what I'm speaking to, Judge Ikuda, is the fact that this kind of mitigating evidence is considered to weigh very heavily by the U.S. Supreme Court.
But the Arizona Supreme Court was aware of the evidence, and it did instruct itself as to whether to consider it or how much weight to give it, whereas a jury would be believed to follow the instructions of the judge of the court.
Well, and again, I think that the Arizona Supreme Court was bound by its own law,
it could change the law, right? It could change its rule.
Well, it was following its own law, according to McKinney, and it was not following federal constitutional law. I also think that this Mr. Poison's case is very similar to the case of James McKinney and Michael Headland. All three of these people suffered traumatic childhoods, had alcoholic parents who were neglectful and violent. Mr. McKinney, Mr. Poison began to withdraw when he was 11 and began using drugs and alcohol. McKinney and Headland suffered from PTSD, but Poison suffered from the effects of prenatal exposure to alcohol and drugs. Both cases involved multiple victims, pecuniary gain and cruelty, and I think that there can be no reason basis to distinguish Mr. Poison's case from the cases of McKinney and Headland, which have been granted relief. One brief point. Mr. Nielsen pointed out that in several months that Mr. Poison lived in the trailers with Ms. Kagan and the others, that nothing had happened. There was no criminal activity, there was no violence, there was no disruption whatsoever. And I think that is an important point, that he lived very peacefully with these people.
peacefully without incident. It wasn't until he was under the influence of an older man who, you know, prompted this crime and who, in fact, was the first instigator of the first act of this crime. And then just very quickly, in Mann, which the state had again relied on and noticed to this court in a 28-J letter, Mann also required a causal nexus, which was impermissible, and that was pointed out in the case of McKinney.
Thank you for your argument, and thank you as well for traveling here. I know both of you have been with this case for a long time, and we appreciate your efforts. Capital cases are complicated, and sometimes it requires a really in-depth view of the record, and both of you have indicated that you really know the record well. So thank you very much for your presentations. The case is starting to be submitted for decision in the field.